Coming up, a congressional hearing examines radicalization in the American Muslim community. What do religious leaders have to say about it? Plus, combat veterans suffering from what's been called moral wounding.
You know, we don't really have a consciousness of our own spirit until it's wounded, and then it needs help.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome. I'm Kim Lawton, sitting in for Bob Abernethy. Thank you for joining us. Faith-based and humanitarian aid groups were gearing up to help victims of the massive earthquake and tsunami that hit Japan and other areas along the Pacific on Friday. The earthquake was the strongest ever recorded in Japan and one of the largest in the world in the last century. The House Committee on Homeland Security this week held the first in a series of controversial hearings examining what it called radicalization in the American Muslim community, and there was widespread religious reaction. The hearing was called by chair of the committee, New York Republican Peter King, who invoked the memory of the 9/11 attacks.
Today, we must be fully aware that homegrown radicalization is part of Al-Qaeda's strategy to continue attacking the United States. Al-Qaeda is actively targeting the American Muslim community for recruitment. Today's hearing will address this dangerous trend.
First up on the witness list was Congressman Keith Ellison, a Democrat from Minnesota and the first Muslim elected to the House of Representatives.
It's true that specific individuals, including some who are Muslims, are violent extremists. However, these are individuals, not entire communities. When you assign their violent actions to the entire community, you assign collective blame to a whole group. This is the very heart of stereotyping and scapegoating.
Ellison became emotional as he described a young Muslim paramedic who was killed on 9/11.
Mohammed Salman Hamdani was a fellow American who gave his life for other Americans. His life should not be identified as just a member of an ethnic group or just a member of a religion, but as an American who gave everything for his fellow Americans.
But several witnesses testified that the U.S. Muslim community is not doing enough to counter radicalism in its midst. Family members described how two young American Muslims were recruited by extremists and persuaded to commit terrorist acts. The president of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy, Zudi Jasser, said his faith is being hijacked by what he called a theopolitical movement that is promoting radicalization.
We have a problem internally. Where is that? It's a minority, but there's an ideology that exists in some mosques, not all, not a majority, but in some mosques, and it's a significant number.
Throughout the week, religious groups mobilized around the hearing. In New York, interfaith supporters joined thousands of Muslims who rallied to show their support for America and their opposition to violence in the name of religion. A smaller counter-rally alleged that Muslims are linked to terrorism. And some in the faith community said Congress should be looking into this.
Name another religion where there's an international coordinated effort today, where there could be an imam in Yemen talking to a member of our military in Texas to carry out an attack on troops or young people recruited. It's not happening.
U.S. Islamic advocacy groups repeatedly accused Congress of unfairly singling out their community. On Capitol Hill, a coalition of prominent leaders from several faith traditions gathered to show their solidarity with American Muslims.
I feel Congressman Ellison's pain. I share the pain. I share his concern that these hearings will only exacerbate anti-Muslim bigotry and Islamophobia in our country.
The group acknowledged that Congress has a responsibility to examine violent extremism, but objected to how this hearing was framed.
I can imagine hearings that would come under the heading of the role of religion in promoting violent extremism that would be able to address the real problem, not a group of people, the vast, vast majority of whom have nothing to do with the problem, rather part of the solution.
Muslims in the group were grateful for the support.
I do believe that by isolating and singling out the community, we're really feeding into the stereotyping and discrimination against the community. But this America that I know, that's standing with me here, that America that I love.
The leaders announced a new interfaith initiative called Shoulder to Shoulder, which they said would promote tolerance and fight anti-Muslim bigotry. Congressman King said he thought the hearing generated a productive and worthwhile conversation. He plans to move ahead with other hearings on the topic in the future. Joining me now is Gustav Niebuhr, Associate Professor of Religion in the Media at Syracuse University and author of the book Beyond Tolerance, Searching for Interfaith Understanding in America. Gustav, welcome. There certainly was an extraordinary conversation around religion this week. What do you think it says about this particular moment in the American religious landscape?
Well, it's really an extraordinary moment and somewhat ironic, too, given that the dominant images of Muslims are people fighting for freedom and human rights in North Africa at this point. But in terms of the United States, it says that there's a lingering suspicion of Muslims as a community. It also says, given the pushback against the hearings, that there are a great many people who are invested in supporting American Muslims as part of the American community and interfaith dialogue.
We did see a big mobilization in the religious community, prominent leaders standing behind Muslims. But at the congregation level, at the pew level, there are these questions lingering about links between violence and Islam. How big of a challenge is that for interfaith relations?
Well, it's a big challenge. For one thing, the dominant media image of Muslims, say between 9/11 and up to 2009, was one of people who were associated with terrorist groups abroad. It was of fighting in between U.S. troops and terrorists in Iraq. But I think things have begun to change over the last 2 years. For one thing, you had a tremendous and ultimately unsuccessful uprising in Iran against the disputed elections there. And then, as I say, very recently, you've had a popular revolution sweeping across North Africa, giving us a completely different image of Muslims. And I hope that that does filter down to the pew level, that people do see that that there are Muslims abroad, and certainly Muslims in the United States, with whom they can agree with.
And we did see diversity within the American Muslim community this week. A lot of people think of it as a monolithic body, but it's really not.
It's anything but. It's anything but. There are, 50, 60 different ethnic groups. There are people who are wealthy. There are people who are white collar. There are all sorts of professionals. There are blue collar people. There are people who have been here since the 1960s, people who've recently arrived. And geographically, the community is very widespread.
How do you think the hearings, the images of this hearing is playing overseas among some of those people you were talking about?
In some ways, I'm concerned about that, because at the very time that you've got people fighting for freedom and human rights in North Africa, you have internationally televised hearings questioning the patriotism of at least some American Muslims. On the other hand, what's hopeful is that people from the administration, the national administration, all the way down to the pew level, have stood with Muslims and stood with Muslims as Americans in this country. And I hope that the latter is received more strongly than the former, at least for American interests abroad.
All right. Gustav Niebuhr, Associate Professor of Religion in the Media at Syracuse University. Thanks a lot for being with us today. In other news, continued humanitarian concerns for Libya. The head of the International Red Cross reported that doctors saw a sharp rise this week in casualties, mostly civilian deaths. The United Nations asked for additional funds to serve the 1 million foreign workers and others they say are trapped inside the country. Faith-based groups continue to provide aid to tens of thousands of refugees who have fled to the Libyan borders with Tunisia and Egypt. Meanwhile, in Cairo, deadly violence erupted again between Muslims and Christians. Tensions had escalated after a group of Muslims burned down a Coptic church south of the city. The fire was reportedly set because of a family feud over an interfaith romance. At least 13 people were killed and more than 100 wounded, most of them Christians. Many local leaders have called for more religious tolerance, but some Copts say they're not being protected by the country's transitional government. Around the world this week, Christians began observing Lent, the solemn 40-day period leading up to Easter. In Rome, Pope Benedict XVI presided over the traditional Ash Wednesday service. At Ash Wednesday services in Philadelphia, Cardinal Justin Regali urged special prayers as the archdiocese deals with a widening sex abuse scandal there. The cardinal placed 21 priests on administrative leave this week, pending an inquiry into allegations that they abused minors. Illinois has become the 16th state to ban the death penalty. Governor Pat Quinn signed a law Wednesday ending capital punishment. He also reduced the sentences of inmates on death row to life without parole. The number of states that still have the death penalty is now at the lowest point in more than 30 years. The Dalai Lama announced this week that he's moving ahead with his plan to step down from his leadership role in the Tibetan government in exile. He will remain the top spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism, but says the time has now come for his political work to end. The 75-year-old Dalai Lama has long signaled his intention to leave politics. Since elections for a new prime minister will begin as early as next week, many believe he may transfer his political responsibilities to that newly elected leader. A new United Nations report this week says that 2010 was the deadliest year for non-combatants in Afghanistan since the beginning of the war. There was a 15% increase in civilian casualties over 2009, with Taliban insurgents blamed for the vast majority of those deaths. Of course, the wars there and in Iraq have taken a heavy toll on members of the military as well. Increasing numbers are coming back with crippling fear and anger, post-traumatic stress disorder. And some combat veterans are suffering guilt and shame associated with what is called moral wounding. Lucky Severson did this report last year.
Happy days in Roswell, New Mexico. A Soldiers in a National Guard Engineer Company deployed in Afghanistan come marching home. For some, unless they get called back, the war is over. For others, it's only begun.
I was a rifleman.
In an infantry unit.
In an infantry line unit.
Marines.
Correct. Marine Corps Infantry.
Michael Abatella joined the Marines September 12, 2001, the day after the terrorist attack on the Twin Trade Towers. Like tens of thousands of American soldiers coming home, he has struggled with the warning signs of post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. Symptoms like nightmares, insomnia, hypervigilance, and guilt. And for him, something even deeper. A wounding of the soul.
Something is changed. You know, you feel down to your spirit, you know, that you're different now. You know, we don't really have a consciousness of our own spirit until it's wounded. And then it needs help.
With the increase in crime and suicide among veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, the notion that war can actually damage or warp the soul has been gaining traction among experts in the field. Nancy Sherman, a professor at Georgetown University, has studied and written extensively about the hearts, minds, and souls of soldiers.
I like to talk about the moral emotions of war, and they include wounds, but they're the hard, bad feelings that may erode at your character. That's the really deep ones.
And I hope that you will work for reconciliation.
The kind of emotional wounds Lieutenant Colonel Eric Olson witnessed as a chaplain in Iraq.
It's a hard place where you're asked to do some very difficult things. And once you've crossed those lines, it's hard to navigate back. It is a soul wound. It's definitely a soul wound.
Michael Abatello is still suffering from the guilt that his unit wasn't there to protect an Afghan father who had provided intelligence on the enemy to the Marines.
He had trusted us to some degree. that we would be there to support him and his family if he was going to be taking chances to help us. And we betrayed his trust to, you know, not even to a certain degree. I mean, we weren't there for him. So yeah, I have guilt.
What happened to him?
Him and his family were gunned down in front of their house. His beard was cut off, and he was stripped and laid on top of his family.
You knew the kids, too, didn't you? Yeah. The kids, the whole family.
Yeah.
A recent survey by the RAND Corporation found that over 300,000 veterans are suffering from some form of PTSD, which has put enormous pressure on veterans' hospitals like this one in Los Angeles, which also houses New Directions, a residential treatment program for veterans. Clinic Director Monica Martocci says no one knows the number of PTSD victims for certain because many veterans refuse to acknowledge it.
It doesn't bode well for their career if they're in any way seen as mentally unstable.
Those who have studied the issue say moral wounding is especially prevalent among recent vets because so many have served more than one tour of duty. Ed Tick operates a sanctuary called Soldier's Heart for stricken veterans and says they aren't the only ones suffering.
20% of active duty troops and as much as 40% of Guards and National Guardsmen and reservists are coming back with PTSD. These are astronomical numbers, and we could go through substance abuse and divorce and child abuse and homicide and imprisoned populations. So they are really hurting.
The Justice Department estimates that nearly a quarter of a million veterans of wars dating back to Vietnam are serving time behind bars. The New York Times found 121 cases in which Iraq and Afghan veterans committed murder after their return from war. Only a few had been screened for mental health problems, and unlike many civilian criminals, the overwhelming majority had no prior criminal record. Dr. Jonathan Shea, a neuroscientist who works with the Veterans Administration, ridicules the age-old theory that good breeding and good character will keep you morally strong even in the face of war.
Well, that idea has a great pedigree, and I'm afraid it's complete crap. It is simply wrong. Moral injury causes good character to become deformed.
It alters it. It alters who you are.
It makes you bitter. It makes you cynical. It makes you filled with hatred.
Michael Abatello had never been in trouble before, but served prison time after his wife convinced him to sell his personal unregistered guns to someone who turned out to be a government informer.
You get so used to having a rifle. You know, I used to get these fears, like I had forgotten my rifle somewhere. And to even imagine life without a rifle is scary.
Monica Martocci says Michael Abatello's attachment to guns is not uncommon.
That's what they were trained to do, and what they learned, especially in combat, is that the world is not a safe place, and they are taught to protect themselves and others. So, I mean, they think everyone else is crazy for not having a weapon with them at all times.
The rate of suicide among vets of the current wars has also been on the rise. A federal study in 2005 found that veterans were twice as likely to commit suicide as those who hadn't served in the military. And PTSD is considered a significant reason why almost 25% of America's homeless are veterans of all wars, even though they make up only 8% of the population.
And thank you for the food that's been provided for us.
The largest number of homeless vets reside in downtown Los Angeles, and many have found help at the venerable Union Rescue Mission. Anthony Ortega now works at Union Mission. He was injured by shrapnel while his National Guard unit was in Afghanistan. He found this place after living on the streets.
And then doing some of the things we have to do as far as serving our country goes against what's in the Bible. But it's either my life or theirs. Coming back, having to deal with that was very difficult.
My
problems came.
Billy Zinnerman was a sergeant major in the Marines. He says the first Gulf War, where he served on reconnaissance patrols, changed him spiritually.
Because you see no spirituality in war. Combat does not, for lack of a better word, expose you to the opportunity to serve the Lord.
After he lost his faith, he lost his wife and his home, and now he's trying to help other veterans at the Los Angeles Mission.
I don't know if you've ever been in a position to say to yourself, if you have believed in God and you think God has abandoned you, that's what you feel in combat. Because you feel there can be no God with this type of carnage going on.
Everyone we spoke with agrees that an important factor in the turbulent return of some vets is that much of the country has not shared the pain of the two wars they have been fighting.
You know, there's lip service to the service and to saluting the service. But does the public really understand in a deep way, empathically, what the moral burdens of war are? I don't think so.
The good news is the Department of Defense has instituted a reintegration plan for returning vets called the Yellow Ribbon Program. Chaplain Eric Olson officiated at this one.
We try to see them as soon as they come home, and in 30 days and 60 days, and we bring them together and sort of tell them what they're going to go through and help them just to navigate that.
And more churches are joining in, like the Unitarian Church here in Albany, New York, which recently sponsored its first Healing Circle ceremony for veterans like Michael Abatello.
I've lost more friends to suicides than I did in combat.
For too many veterans, coming home doesn't end with kisses and hugs. Now there's an increasing awareness, and some say an urgent need for America and Americans to step up and share the pain of our returning veterans and help them reclaim their lives. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson reporting.
Finally, on our calendar, for Eastern Orthodox Christians, Sunday is known as the Sunday of Orthodoxy, the celebration of a 9th century church ruling that restored the use of icons in the liturgy. For Irish and non-Irish alike, Thursday is St. Patrick's Day, commemorating the popular 5th century patron saint of Ireland. And as we noted earlier, Eastern and Western Christians are observing the Lenten period of reflection and repentance. Many Western Christians began Lent with the special Ash Wednesday service, where they received ashes on their foreheads or the top of their heads as a symbol of penitence and mortality. Lent is a very somber time, but it's often preceded with celebration, sometimes frivolity and excess, witness Mardi Gras and Carnival. Many American churches have borrowed the English tradition of Shrove Tuesday, also called Pancake Day. At Washington's National Cathedral, they held a traditional pancake race.
Praise God from whom all syrup flows. Praise him, O pancakes tossed below.
In England, this is Shrove Tuesday is known as Pancake Day, and the pancake races are somewhat legendary. They date to the 15th century. People were encouraged going into Lent to use up all of the sweet and fattening things in their pantries. And so pancakes was a way to use up your butter and your eggs and your flour and your sugar. The races, the legend has it that a woman was cooking her pancakes on her stovetop when she heard the noonday church bells ringing, and she realized that she was late for church. And so she grabbed her pancakes off the stove and ran through the town with her skillet and her pancake to get to church on time. The general rules are that all the runners have to flip their pancake 3 times while they run, and that if they drop their pancake, they have to recite a poem as a penalty. And that poem is, "Pancakes are good, pancakes are greasy, I thought flipping pancakes was going to be easy." And as you saw here today, an awful lot of people dropped their pancakes. I'm not sure a lot of them followed our rules exactly, but I know that everybody had a good time.
I was the champion of all champions. Secret. Practice, endurance, and faith.
That's our program for now. I'm Kim Lawton. There's much more on our website about Ash Wednesday observances and the congressional hearings on American Muslims. You can comment on all of our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook, where I have a fan page too. You can also find us on YouTube and watch us anytime, anywhere, on smartphones and iPhones with our mobile web app. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes from Ash Wednesday in Rome.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be more.